Welcome to Worlds Apart. The paragon of American humor, Mark Twain, famously remarked that a good lawyer knows the law, a clever one takes the judge to lunch. Had he been witness to the current politics of his country, he may have added prescriptions for prosecutors, campaign donors, and sex workers. With Trump and Biden seemingly set for another ballot standoff and legal cases hovering above them and their family members, who is likely to face the music? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Robert Barnes, an American constitutional lawyer. Mr. Barnes, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here.
Now, first of all, I'm curious, do you think of yourself as a good lawyer who, according to Mark Twain, needs to know the law, or a clever one who relies on his personal connections to help his cases? And given the state of the American justice system, which strategy do you think is most efficient?
As a practical matter, Mark Twain is right if your client is a politically connected or privileged individual. If your client, almost all of my clients are underdogs and outsiders, so consequently, any invitation to lunch would be declined. So consequently, my only choice is to be a good lawyer in court.
Okay, so justice only works by the book when it comes to underdogs, but when it comes to privileged people, there is a whole set of rules, right?
No doubt. And people are witnessing that on the American political right. It's been known on different segments of the American political spectrum over the last century or so. Different people have experienced it at different times in our legal history. But now people on the what you could loosely call the political right are seeing it in live time, seeing how Trump is treated, seeing the different standards, seeing how the January 6th defendants are treated versus the Summer of Love protest rioters are treated. They're witnessing in live time just how disparate and discriminatory, unfortunately, our American legal system has become.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the legal treatment of Donald Trump, and I initially was intent on discussing his indictment in connection with Stormy Daniels' case, but since then, he was found guilty of sexually abusing, although not raping, magazine writer Jean Carroll all the way back in 1996. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's possible only in the United States that somebody would wait 27 years until her 79th birthday to pursue such charges in a pre-election year in a state that just recently removed the statute of limitations for sexual crimes. What's your take on this case?
Yeah, I mean, what it shows is how bad and weak her case was, that the jury did not find any rape occurred. In fact, they didn't even check the box on whether sexual abuse took place. They just said assigned damages for the tort of battery, that you have a New York jury. You have a very hostile federal judge to Trump in the way he presided over the trial. And despite all of that, they still couldn't find him guilty of the main accusation against him. So I think Trump's people will take that as the only victory they could get. But it shows how bad our legal system is. The District of Columbia jury pools have proven that in a range of cases. And now New York's jury pools are proving the same thing. Trying a person that of Trump's notoriety in the jurisdiction that has a bunch of people that hate him makes no sense. I think all but one of the jurors was a Democrat, a registered Democrat in New York City. That was a place that voted 90% against Trump. That's not a place that could be impartial. And as you know, the case was a crazy case. She was someone who had no witnesses to vouch for it, no independent evidence, didn't come forward for decades later, hated Trump. Every witness in her trial either hated Trump or was paid by the plaintiff's lawyers. The whole case was paid for by a big tech guy who hates Trump. So it's just a lawfare on steroids, which America's used to seeing in other parts of the world. They're not as accustomed to seeing it in America.
Now, Mr. Barnes, this is not the first sexual scandal that Trump has been associated with. Our viewers may recall the alleged golden showers in Moscow described in now fully discredited and quickly forgotten Steele dossier. That didn't seem to affect Trump's reputation much, and yet these allegations keep resurfacing. If they are politically motivated, as you have suggested before, why do you think Trump's opponents keep pressing the same rusty lever when it clearly doesn't deliver?
Because the American legal establishment and political establishment and the political class as a whole is used to the American public accepting the results of judges and juries. So they figure if a judge says it, if a jury says it, that will get Americans to reject that person and accept whatever the judge or jury says. What's happened over the Trump era is that Americans have quit trusting even our judges and trusting even our juries. Just as they no longer trust our experts, they no longer trust our media, they no longer trust anybody in a position of authority because they keep lying to them and they catch them lying to them. And especially when it comes to Trump, they don't believe anything. The Trump supporters don't believe the accusations against him because they're, as you noted with Russiagate, there have been so many false accusations made against Trump.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Russiagate, I mean, you know, that case, that dossier hugely damaged not only the relationship between our two countries, but it undermined global politics a great deal. I mean, that's one of the reasons we are on the brink of a nuclear war right now, you know, our two countries. And yet, I don't remember anyone being prosecuted or convicted for outright falsehoods that are contained in that.
Oh, indeed. In fact, the one lawyer who was prosecuted was given a sweetheart deal. He never served a day in jail. His law license was reinstated a year later. I mean, and this is someone who lied to the highest, well, to one of the highest courts in the land, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Activity Court, to allow mass spying to occur, to allow a mass deception to occur. So it's our entire legal system has always had issues, but it's just coming to the bear. It's coming to the forefront as people witness it in live time when it concerns Trump. Almost all the charges against Trump are so overtly and openly and brazenly political and partisan that nobody trusts them. And there's no better example of that. The fact they're scared to bring a case against Trump in a jurisdiction that has conservatives. They only look at the District of Columbia or the city of Atlanta or the city of New York. They won't look at bringing the case with Trump's own jury pool because they know that Trump's own jury pool won't accept it as being true. And it's because it's not true, typically.
Now, let's talk about the treatment of the other side. And one revelation that surfaced recently in the Wall Street Journal is how many American power players continued to meet with convicted sex offender and pedophile Jeffrey Epstein after his conviction, including people like the current CIA director, William Burns, who at that time was serving as deputy secretary of state. And he had meetings scheduled with Epstein, convicted sex offender, in Epstein's own private mansion. And the same goes for Obama's presidential advisor or for, you know, a college president. What does it say to you about the informal ways of power and influence in America?
Well, in the post-World War II era, the American sort of deep state, as it came to be known or called, or some people call it the national security establishment or the military industrial complex, really kind of entrenched its power across the media spectrum, across the university spectrum, across our corporate institutions, across our global institutions. As Robert Kennedy Jr. just said, as he's running for president, he attributes to the CIA and those bad actors, the assassination of both his father and his uncle, President John Kennedy. And part of all that goes back to always having honey traps, being involved in sex trafficking operations, being involved in various kind of illicit operations around the world to blackmail and extort targeted individuals. And Jeffrey Epstein, not coincidentally, was connected to Robert Maxwell, the British publisher who had connections to intelligence operations all around the globe. He came from the Dalton School, where he got his first break, the Dalton School. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken went to that same Dalton School. William Barr's, the attorney general, former attorney general's father, was the headmaster right before Epstein was hired at the Dalton School. So you have an elite prep school tie-ins. You go deeper, there's tie-ins between Blinken's father and Epstein. So it's not a surprise. Epstein was, I believe, the centerpiece of kind of a honey trap extortion operation, blackmail operation for intelligence agencies around the world. He had ties to Robert Mueller. The reason why he got a sweetheart deal was most likely he was a secret informant for the FBI under Robert Mueller. This goes back. Robert Mueller has ties to other people that did operations similar to that out of San Francisco. that people can look up. So it's not a surprise. It's just an underbelly of American and global institutional power we don't often get to see in live terms. Mm-hmm. And do I think that's what's coming out.
Do I understand you correctly? Am I hearing you correctly that you believe that all these parties that Epstein was involved in organizing, involving teenage girls or very young women, you believe that it was not only for the sexual gratification of their participants, but possibly a scheme, a means for co-opting for further control?
Oh, no doubt. It was a classic blackmail extortion ring. That it's not only about providing the illicit services to an elite group of people who otherwise can't find that easily that access to that illicit activity, but it's also to blackmail and extort them. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think some of the efforts failed. I think like the effort to get material on, say, an Alan Dershowitz didn't ultimately work out because he didn't take the bait, but nor do I think Noam Chomsky, who apparently met multiple times with him, I don't think he took the bait on any of that. But most likely because he was also involved in eugenics and involved in a lot of weird science that, you know, Epstein. But I think the long-term goal and objective in each one of these cases was to entrap and ensnare these people in a world that could then be used against them. According to the various reports, there were lots of video cameras all over Epstein Island. And we just don't know whatever happened to all of that material. But all of it has the forensic fingerprints of a blackmail operation involving Western intelligence agencies.
Now, I don't know if it's accurate, but I've read somewhere that Trump's resort in Mar-a-Lago was absolutely off limits for Epstein's parties. And if that's true, that I think that raises a very interesting question about morality, because it's one thing to, you know, pursue adult women, even as an extramarital affair. And it's quite a different matter to, you know, buy the bodies and ravage the souls of teenage girls. What do you think about that?
So early on, Epstein was reported as harassing some young women at Mar-a-Lago. So Trump banned him from Mar-a-Lago. And you can find some old interviews where he kept hinting at Epstein's issues. There's, I think, a Vanity Fair piece that was very favorable to Epstein, where Trump keeps saying, well, he has a reputation for very young girls, where he's trying to put out there what's going on. They tried to connect Trump to Epstein. Ultimately, it was unsuccessful because Trump was one of the few people that kept his distance from Epstein over many years once he found out what he was about. But it reflects the sad nature of our intel system. But the Trump has to be one of the highest integrity people on the planet, because to be a New York real estate titan and all they can find on you is some affairs.
Well, but this is not just fascinating, but I mean, it's totally it's hard to understand for somebody like myself how, you know, the Democrats would be waxing poetic about, you know, all the crimes or all the moral, you know, character of Trump, while you know, seemingly knowing about things that are going on within their own camp. I mean, it's beyond comprehension.
I call it confession through projection. So you look at all the crimes they accuse Trump of, and it's pretty much what the Biden family has done. So, like, they accuse Trump of being engaged with various foreign corruption scams, and now it's coming out that the Biden family was taking money from almost anybody around the world to line their pockets. The Democrats accuse Trump of various sexual misconduct. There's all kinds of allegations circulating Biden concerning that and concerning far worse misconduct. So I think what you see is a lot of confession through projection. What they accuse Trump of is what they themselves are guilty of.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps even worse. Well, Mr. Barnes, we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Robert Barnes, an American constitutional lawyer. Mr. Barnes, going back to the Stormy Daniels case, you've been pretty vocal that Donald Trump's indictment is very weak on both legal and factual grounds. In fact, it doesn't even mention what federal law Trump supposedly violated, and yet it was brought about in a very forceful, very conspicuous way in a pre-election year. So I assume people who are behind it are pretty confident about what they're doing. How do you understand their rationale as a lawyer?
I mean, I think their rationale is power. It's an appeal to power rather than appeal to principle. So the New York District Attorney's office knows that his office has a lot of power. The New York judges tend to be very deferential to the New York District Attorney's office. And the New York appeals courts have been very hostile to Trump individually. He's got a jury pool that pretty much despises Trump, voted against him 90-10. Has a, you know, about 80% of them have a very unfavorable view of Trump. So I think that's what he's betting on. Now, Trump removed the case from state court to federal court, and he's asking a United States federal district court to take control over the case. If that happens, that throws a big wrench into the state prosecutor, because all of a sudden it's a different jury pool, different judicial pool, different appeals process, and all of it's unparalleled and unprecedented in American legal history. But they're willing to break all the norms to go after Trump.
Do you think the justice or judicial branch is independent enough or invested enough in its independency to go by the book rather than political considerations? Because it's one thing, whatever they think about Trump, they surely must have some loyalty to their own profession and to the law as such.
They should, but not often in the city of New York, in my experience. I mean, I represented Amy Cooper, the so-called Central Park Karen in New York, and my experience with the system is that it's very political. In fact, New York's probably one of the most political jurisdictions in the country, other than the District of Columbia. They're probably the two most political jurisdictions where you have a lot of juries, judges, prosecutors, lawyers, too many that just don't care about the rule of law, and they care about how it looks politically in a court of public opinion. And so I think that's the risk Trump faces. I don't think he can get a fair trial from a state court in Manhattan. I think they should either remove either the federal court should take the case, or he should remove it to Staten Island. And then I think he could get a fair jury.
Now, I heard you say in another interview that even if Trump had paid Stormy Daniels through his campaign coffers, that's constitutionally protected under U.S. law. What's the point of channeling money this way then?
It's basically for saving yourself from political embarrassment. But, you know, we do gag orders every day in America, settlements in a wide range of cases, entirely constitutional and legal. And then from a campaign perspective, you're allowed, if you're spending your own money, you're allowed to do whatever you want. And there's many people who believe that even if that the mere fact that it's an indirect benefit on the campaign is not enough to make it a campaign donation. This came up in the John Edwards case. It would have been litigated up on the Court of Appeals, but they couldn't secure convictions in the John Edwards case. In the John Edwards case, you had a presidential candidate who somebody else was paying off his mistress. Here you have Trump paying off an alleged mistress. Well, that's entirely under the U.S. Constitution, under the First Amendment. No campaign law can limit what you spend on your own behalf. And so that's why he has a constitutionally protected right to do whatever he wants. That's why they're going through some procedural shenanigans to try to escape the Constitution's restrictions on their charges.
Mr. Barnes, campaign donations and billings have been used by previous Democratic administrations in a pretty laissez-faire way. It's no secret here in Russia that prior to this huge fallout between Moscow and Washington, a number of Russian banks and state-connected enterprises made contributions to the Clinton Foundation. I think that was also raised as a concern in the cables released by WikiLeaks. Why do you think this issue of campaign financing is only becoming an issue now?
They're basically looking at hyper-technical ways to go after him. And it is a case of confession through projection, because they look at the crimes they committed and try to accuse Trump of them. And this fits a pattern going all the way back. Because Hillary Clinton actually did commit this crime in 2016. She procured the so-called Russiagate dossier through those laundered as a that was not listed as a campaign expense. It was listed as a legal expense at the Perkins Coie law firm. And so that she could hide her fingerprints in it, that ended up in a federal court record because there was subordination of perjury and false affidavit submitted to a federal court saying that it was not a campaign part of the process. So that's an example of a real campaign crime. And instead of prosecuting Hillary Clinton, they just accused Trump of something that's just on a much smaller scale than what Hillary Clinton actually did right there in the city of New York.
Mm-hmm. Now, as has recently emerged, Barack Obama also may have benefited from some very questionable donations, which compared to alleged payoff to Stormy Daniels, seems to be far more, well, conspicuous, because in the case of Trump, he's accused of using his own money, but in the case of Obama, the talk is about some shady financier from God knows where. Do you think, given Obama's venerated status among the liberals, do you think that case will be given a go?
I don't think there's any chance that either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton will ever face the same degree of scrutiny or criminal prosecution that Trump has done. Trump's true crime has been to be an independent, dissident voice on American foreign policy. And that almost every president who has ever voiced that, the most prominent one being John Kennedy, has faced harsh consequences from sort of the deep state apparatus. All of Trump's charges have that fingerprint on it. And there's no better example of that than the disparate treatment. Barack Obama committed real campaign crimes. There'll be no prosecution. Hillary Clinton committed real campaign crimes. There'll be no prosecution. Biden has been committing crimes for 40 years and his whole family. There'll be no prosecution.
Now, speaking about Biden's family, you alluded to that before, and it's well known in this part of the world that his son and a couple of his associates, also offsprings of prominent Democratic families, have been involved in deals that involved, if not nepotism, then clear influence trading. There are proven records of that. Do you think the American justice system can deal with that? And I'm not asking about fairness here or blindness of the American justice system, but given that there seems to be a lot of infighting, political infighting, even within the Biden administration between various camps, do you think that case could be used by the Democrats themselves in fighting for power?
I think if they had somebody that could replace Biden as vice president, they would use that as extortion to get Biden to resign from the White House, cite health grounds, but basically use the, because everybody in Washington has known that the Biden uses his whole family, his sisters, his brothers, his son, you name it, in some cases, nieces and nephews, to engage to basically enrich his family through public office. And so then Hunter was just off the chain in terms of the scale of corruption and crimes that he was involved in, whether it was tax crimes.
As well
crimes,
as his own public behavior. I mean, let's not forget all his dealings with prostitution and, you know, abuses and addictions, et cetera.
Exactly. And so you add that. I mean, there's already suspicion from the Arkansas court where Hunter Biden has a child support proceeding involving a child that he had out of wedlock, that he's hiding income from his art dealing. And a lot of his art dealing looks like money laundering to a lot of people. As soon as his dad is president, all of a sudden his art is worth tons of money. Art, of course, is infamously known for its money laundering capacity. So there's so many places and cases that they could bring against him. I think the problem they have is a simple one. Even though Biden is kind of a dementia candidate in the White House with all these corruption issues, they could easily use as leverage. Who's going to replace him? Nobody likes Kamala Harris. Nobody likes any other Democratic candidate who could replace them. So right now, the Democratic Party in the deep state is kind of stuck with a notoriously corrupt president.
Well, it's not just notoriously corrupt. I mean, Mr. Barnes, I mean, it's just my personal remark. But when we look at his cognitive ability, it's pretty scary to think about what's going on behind the scenes, because that man is entrusted with the most powerful weapons on this planet. And, you know, in every other public appearance, he barely knows where he is. And that's, I don't know why that doesn't bother the Americans. I mean, I have no personal investment in whoever wins. I think it would be still bad for Russia, but it's pretty scary on when you consider the global security.
No doubt. I mean, a recent ABC Washington Post poll found that 60% of Americans believe that Biden does not have the mental capacity or cognizance level to be president of the United States, and that his health suggests he can't be president. That's what everybody can witness. It shows how bad the Democratic Party has fatigued that they don't have an easy replacement. If they were conscientious, they would embrace Robert Kennedy's campaign, but they despise Robert Kennedy's campaign, the Democratic Party establishment, much as they did his father. So consequently, they're stuck with this corrupt idiot in the White House.
Now, Mr. Barnes, going back to your point that the Democrats' favorite way of operating is confession through projection. As a student of collective psychology, I think it's always been that way with the Americans. You just like projecting your shadow onto other nations or group of people. But I think it was never as blunt and primitive as it is right now. There was a degree of sophistication and even elegance in previous political scams, like, let's say, Watergate. Why do you think it's becoming so crude?
It's the degradation of our elite, so that we've gone from Kissinger types, whose moral compass was probably always broken, but at least was intellectually competent and capable. Now we have the same lack of a moral compass, but people whose intellect is severely damaged. You're talking about people of three, four generations of upper middle class, privileged backgrounds. They grow up in safe spaces as kids. They don't serve in the military. They don't serve in law enforcement. They have little connection to those who do. They don't know the working class and the working populations of the country. And so they're a lot like the British colonial elites of the early 19th century, early 20th century, late 19th century, where they're just decaying. They're part of an apparatus that just feeds itself and is parasitic towards its own population.
Now, finally, I know that you won almost €500,000 after betting on Trump to win the 2016 elections. Are you placing any bets for 2024?
My bet would be on Trump again. DeSantis will not be a meaningful challenger to him in the primaries. I think all these indictment and lawfare efforts will only strengthen him. Constitutionally, they can't prohibit him from being on the ballot. I think that there's a lot of his supporters that every time they see an attack on him, they see even more reason to support him. They're like, well, we're clearly right. We're right that he's going to challenge the system. We're right that he's going to be better the second time around, or otherwise the whole system wouldn't be trying to take him out.
Do you think they will allow him to govern properly? Because the last time he won, he struggled a great deal.
That's going to be the most interesting aspect, because it's a lot like 1968, where the, if Robert Kennedy won, what was the system going to do, given that he planned on implementing the rest of his brother's agenda and going in a very dramatic direction? Hopefully we don't see that outcome here, but but that's where Kennedy's challenge to Trump also, to Biden also presents options. They're kind of each other's security of a sort. The better Kennedy does, that helps Trump and vice versa. And so I think that I don't know how the system's going to react. All efforts to take out Trump have failed. What happens if Trump is the one that takes the inauguration? What do they do next? If they're smart, they're looking at where they can go, and there's no extradition.
Mr. Barnes, we have to leave it here. Thank you very much for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.